From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, The Boom. We talk about fracking. Here's what's happening, though. The federal agency that backed down over the weekend in a very tense standoff with a Nevada rancher is being accused of leaving a trail of wreckage behind. The damage includes holes in water tanks, destroyed water lines and fences, according to family friends. They even say that the Bureau hired people who killed two prize bulls. Has not been proven yet, but who knows? They had a total control of the land for 1 week, said Corey Houston, a friend of Clevin Bundy and his family. So why would you trust somebody like that? The BLM, that's the Bureau of Labor Management, and other law enforcement officials backed down on Saturday in an effort to seize Bundy's cattle after hundreds of protesters, some armed, arrived to show support for the Bundy family. In the end, BLM officials left the scene amid concerns about safety. No shots fired. We'll continue to monitor the story. FBI counterterrorism agents are visiting gun shops, apparently, in South Carolina to investigate suspicious purchases made by people who talk about big government. This is a story that was broken on Infowars.com. The author, Brandon Turville, says that he was approached by an individual who works in a Columbia, South Carolina gun shop to relay the story of just how an FBI agent entered the store, showed his credentials before proceeding to ask a series of stunning questions, like telling the gun store worker that he was tasked with visiting all firearms outlets in the local area to check on suspicious purchases for counterterrorism purposes. The agent then began discussing what, in actual fact, were completely normal transactions, such as paying with cash, purchasing long guns, and other similar behavior. Strange story there. The kill switch, a system for remotely disabling smartphones and wiping their data, will become standard in 2015, according to a pledge backed by most of the mobile world's major players, Apple, Google, Samsung, Microsoft, along with five biggest cellular carriers in the United States, are among those that have signed on to a voluntary program announced by the industry's largest trade group. All smartphones manufactured for sale in the United States after July 2015 must have the technology. In a moment, Lauren Weinstein joins us for an hour on the high-tech world. We'll talk with him about that story and so many others. Well, here we go again. Another coasttocoastam.com and AM radio guest has died. Respected political researcher, social justice worker, Judge John Judge, founder of the Coalition on Political Assassinations, has passed away. He was just on with us talking about the Kennedy assassination several months ago. This is now the seventh coast-to-coast guest to die over the last, 12 months. Emergency services are continuing to search for nearly 300 people missing after a ferry carrying more than 470 people sank off the coast of South Korea. Officials say 179 people have been rescued so far. Most of the passengers on board were students and teachers from the same high school on a field trip. Sad story. Eight people confirmed dead. Captain Kelly Sweeney with us. He's with us when we just deal with all kinds of sea-type tragedies. Kelly, how could this ship flip like this, and how could they not find the other 300 people?
Well, hi, George. Well, those are both good questions, really. The Korean passenger ship Sewol may have hit a submerged object, possibly an abandoned cargo container, or it might have had an equipment malfunction because a loud noise was reported by some of the survivors. And there were some things that were very disturbing to me. 475 passengers aboard were reportedly told to stay put and not move instead of donning life jackets or proceeding to the life rafts. And as you pointed out, there are nearly 300 that are still missing, and although there have been reports of text messages to parents from teenagers who were trapped inside the sunken ship, George, the last one reported saying, "Mom, I love you." Now, there are over 100 vessels have responded and are now trying to perform a rescue, but it's going to be very difficult. And, of course, as time goes on, the longer anybody's in there, the more difficult it is going to be to find survivors.
That's another tragic story. Go ahead.
It sure is, George. Now, U.S. regulations require a full safety orientation before passenger ships can leave the dock. But international regulations that this Korean ship followed are more lax. And even though the international rules that will come into effect next year, new ones will come into effect next year as a result of the Costa Concordia disaster in Italy, unfortunately, they don't have to be followed yet. But all I'll say about this right now is this. The officers and crew on board this passenger ship had a responsibility for the safety of the people on board. And there will definitely be an investigation to follow, and it will focus on the captain who survived.
All right, Kelly, thanks. Let's watch this story as this one unfolds. My gosh. Federal Reserve Chairperson Janet Yellen says that the U.S. economy appears to be slowly moving toward the full employment level, but that it would need some help from the central bank for some time to come. That means they're going to probably keep interest rates at the bottom level that they've been at for a while. Let's check in with investment advisor Mish Shedlock. Mish, what do you think of this one?
Yeah, well, you got that right. I mean, she keeps repeating the same message here, that we're going to monitor the data, We think we're slowly recovering. My gosh, George, originations now for the last 2 months keep hitting lower and lower levels on home loans, and we are already back to actually record all-time lows in originations. So if housing is no longer going to lead the economy, and if growth in China is slowing, I just don't see where the growth is going to come from. Meanwhile, tensions are really heating up in Ukraine.
Yes.
They're on the verge of civil war, and my gosh, George, I really, really hope it doesn't come to that. But the pro-Russian people in eastern Ukraine took over several more cities recently, and in fact, they're now controlling another region, and the Ukrainian government is essentially letting it happen, almost like another Crimea here in the Donetsk region of Ukraine. So I suspect another region is going to go to Russia. Meanwhile, the U.S. is pressuring for more sanctions, but Germany, Italy, and the U.K. are telling Obama to butt out of it because they have more at stake over in Europe than we do here if we impose sanctions on Russia and Russia retaliates by shutting off natural gas to Europe. That's what it's come down to, George.
Mish, do you think we're on the brink of a third world war?
Oh, my gosh, George. You know, I worry about that stuff. I mean, look at, you have to go beyond here. But the warmongering in the United States against Russia is really maddening. But more worrisome, and it's not been in the news that much lately, is the tensions rising between Japan and China.
Yes.
And Japan is trying to remilitarize. You have a separatist region in Spain that wants to break away. The Eurozone, I think the Euro is faltering. What that means, you know, how that breaks apart, but global tensions have never been higher. The unemployment rate in Europe is an absolute disaster. I just don't think, and we've discussed this before, that the U.S. can decouple. So we have a lot of forces here, and a lot of people who are actually in the United States itching to get into some sort of war with Russia. The whole setup is really, really bad news, George.
All right, Mish, thank you. Tomorrow for the first couple hours, we'll be talking about some world events that will include the possibility of a third world war, something nobody really wants to talk about, but you have to address it. By the way, men prefer to watch film adaptations of books than read the original novel, according to a new study, which found that the opposite was true for women. Researchers found that 75% of the men would opt for the big screen version of a story, while 30% admitted that they had not picked up a book since they were at school. Well, up next, we talk about the Tech Hour. Lauren Weinstein joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Lauren Weinstein, of course, has been involved with the development of all kinds of high-tech areas. He is a regular contributor here on Coast to Coast, as I turn to him for all kinds of advice on computers, the internet, and other technologies. His websites are linked up for you right now at coasttocoastam.com. This is fun. For a chance, I get to talk to you for a whole hour, Lauren. Welcome to the show.
No, thank you very much. It's always fun to do the news segments, but having a full hour to explore these topics in more depth is always welcome.
Let's talk a little bit about this one story about the kill switch that might be standard on U.S. phones in 2015. Is that a reality? Is that really possible?
Yeah, it's unfortunately the term kill is kind of, you know, dramatic in this context. Actually, functions like this are already present on an optional basis for iOS, for like Apple iPhones, more recent versions of Android, Google's Android system support this also. They have various ways. And what we're really talking about is a mechanism that allows users to go to their like desktop computers or their laptop computers and remotely tell their remote devices, their mobile devices, cell phones usually, that they should either be, they want to know where they are, they can be located, or, and this brings us back to this kill switch concept, to wipe them clean, delete the data that's on them, disable them, and just try to make them as useless as possible to someone who has stolen them. And what's brought this on is that for a number of years, there's been this concern that cell phones are a highly prized item to be stolen in many cities, major cities. And what happens is thieves will get hold of these and they'll reprogram the serial numbers and then they'll get them activated again.
Right.
And the argument has been that the cellular carriers have kind of been dragging their feet on ways to prevent that from, you know, being a lucrative kind of business. So what's happened now, like you were saying during the news, is that there's been a voluntary agreement by most of the major players in this to provide an optional, and this is a key thing, this is an optional feature that users would need to enable, as I understand it, that would mean that if their phone was stolen, they could then come back and or ask the phone company or whoever their carrier is to then go and disable the phone for them or delete the data on it. Now, interestingly, some of the proponents of this are not happy about this agreement because it is a voluntary system. It's one where the user has to choose to opt into it. And there are some people that say that's not good enough. Everybody has to be required to have this on their phones because too many people won't bother to turn it on before their phone is stolen, and then it'll be, you know, too late. That's the argument. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah, I would guess most people won't even want to use it on their phones.
One of the concerns, and it's an obvious thing that comes up when people think about this, is whether this could be hacked, right? You know, does this provide a mechanism for somebody to remotely get in there and wipe your phone out from under you when you're still trying to use it or disable it? And the answer is, yeah, it could be. It depends on how well the system is designed. Obviously, nothing is foolproof. And, I think there will be some people who, for reasons that they consider to be quite valid, will not want to avail themselves of this. And there's certainly arguments on both sides of this, really.
And, you know, one of the things I've noticed, Lauren, that when somebody goes out, a man or a woman, when they go out, a lot of them just put their phones, their smartphones, right on the table where they're sitting, whether they're at a restaurant or a bar or whatever. Sometimes they get up, they go to the restroom, they keep their phone there, it's gone when they come back, or they forget it when they leave. That's kind of dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know why people do that, actually.
No.
I mean, I keep mine in my pocket or somewhere where I have control over it all the time. To me, it's an expensive little beastie, and I don't want anything to happen with it. I think sometimes people put them on the table, they're kind of showing each other what they've got there, you know. But I'm not in favor of leaving your cell phones on tables while you go to the restroom or whatever.
Well, and you know, when you're out to dinner with somebody, put the phone away, right?
Most of the time I turn mine off. I go to airplane mode, you know, or turn it off. I don't, you know, I get so many notifications. I get so many notifications in the course of normal situations that if I want to actually have a conversation with somebody, I have to turn the notifications off, and I even turn the vibrator off because I don't want to be having anything buzzing all the time. And then when I'm back to, you know, a situation where I can interact with the phone in a reasonable way, I put it back to normal conditions.
So I'm in my studio here in the cave in St. Louis, and one of my computers, it was supported by Windows XP.
Yeah.
And, of course, Microsoft no longer supporting that. And I noticed, last week or so when the support died, when it went away, I was getting all kinds of messages and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm talking to my IT people in Los Angeles, and they're going to work on getting me some new equipment here. But, you know, I'll be back in L.A. by the time I get that, so I'll have to get it when I come back, you know, a month or so later. But it's was this a way to force people to buy more software?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, as much as I like to bash Microsoft as a general principle, the truth is that they have had a fairly well-established what they call a life cycle on these products. You know, for how many years they're going to provide different kinds of support for them, and XP. Years ago, we knew when XP was going to reach the end of that cycle. And in fact, I believe Microsoft actually extended that a little bit because of concerns over that. I think what led to the problem here was that XP was really quite good enough for so many people. And what came after XP was Vista, which was just pretty much an awful thing. Then Windows 7, which was also very good. So you have this situation where people just are very comfortable with what they're running. When you make big jumps in the operating system version, sometimes your hardware becomes obsolete because you can't get drivers anymore for it. And XP just became basically a victim of its own success. And while Windows 7 has been very, very popular, Windows 8, it's a different story. I mean, there's been a lot of concern about Windows 8. When people go out and they buy new PCs now, they're going to have 8 on it automatically. In fact, that's the way most people are getting it now. I don't think you're seeing a lot of people trying to upgrade from 7 to 8 relatively. So Microsoft gets their cut that way. But it's interesting because they did announce, you can see that some of the problems they've got, because they announced that I believe for all computers, and it's supposed to be tablets and things, that were 9-inch displays or smaller, they decided mm-hmm. to make Windows 8 free rather than charging the OEMs, the manufacturers, for it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's really the first time they've done something on that scale. So that suggests that Microsoft is still trying to kind of find their way in the current environment, I think.
Lorne, the business of hacking, is it big business? I mean, is it really organized? You know, if you go into, is there some building somewhere, let's say in China or wherever these things occur, where it's got a gorgeous building, they've got nice furniture, and inside are a bunch of people hacking away?
You mean as opposed to the basement with all the cameras?
Yeah, I mean, is it like a business all to itself?
Yeah, well, you have to remember, but back in the day, you know, when I got started and all this, hacking wasn't a dirty word. I mean, hacking had nothing to do with criminal activity. It was just being really engaged in these things, sitting there writing code at 2 a.m. and all of that.
Yeah.
That's what we called hacking back then, and the word kind of got kidnapped along the way for other purposes. And you have, when you look at the spectrum of things that go on now with what you would call non-good hacking, I guess, that sector, you have a whole range of different kinds of players. You have the people that are just in it to see what they can do and what they can learn and what they can get into, and they don't really have evil intent, though sometimes bad things will happen in the course of them doing it. And then you have the real serious criminal types that are out there trying to collect the financial data and funneling it off to credit card purchasers purchase points in Moscow or something. And there are organized crime gangs that can leverage some of this, but that's a particular sector of it. It's not the whole gamut of people that hack.
That's amazing stuff, Lorne. What else is out there in the world of new technology that the public just doesn't know or we're not aware of?
Well, there's a lot of things going on. I mean, one of the things right now, of course, that I think is worth mentioning, because there's been so much talk about it over the last few days, is this Heartbleed situation.
It's
continuing to take a lot of attention, and we're kind of getting new revelations about it every day. But to put it all together into a way that makes sense for an ordinary user isn't really very easy, because while this is a big problem for the people that run servers and that run services, if they are running vulnerable versions and they hadn't been doing their work to keep things up, I personally don't think it's that big a problem for individuals.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Lorne. Yeah, let's talk about why you say that, and we'll take some phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Lorne Weinstein with us. We're going to take your phone calls, too, as we talk high-tech. Lorne, you were talking about Heartbleed. Let's let you finish your thoughts on that.
Yeah, what I was going to say is it's an unusual exploit, because it's not like when somebody gets hold of a password file or a password hash file or something that has a lot of people's credentials in it that can be exploited or possibly exploited in some manner. It's a lot more. Can you remember the old claw games where you would put coins in and you could control the claw and kind of reach in and try to grab a prize?
I could never grab a prize with those things.
Yeah.
The prize just didn't fit those claws for some reason.
Yeah, it's like that though, because what the Heartbleed exploit does is it sort of reaches into a random section of memory, or a random from the standpoint of the user anyway, on the server. And maybe it gets something good, or maybe it just gets worthless stuff. It's not like it's just going to easily find passwords or social security numbers or something like that. It's just kind of get what it gets. And it can be tried multiple times. And if somebody has enough time to do it, enough resources, they can keep pulling and try to get it that way. But what that means is that from the standpoint of an ordinary user, an individual user, the probability of something getting grabbed that way that's going to affect them, given the versions of OpenSSL that were involved and a bunch of other technical factors, seems relatively low for an individual user. So my recommendation on this has been not to panic, not to go around into changing every password mode in a way where you're going to get confused and maybe lose track of what you're doing. Just practice the usual kind of safe password procedures that we've talked about many times before. Choose good passwords, don't share them among different services, and if the services provide two-factor authentication where you can get a phone call or a text message or use an authenticator app for that second factor, that can be the most important thing you can do, because that way, if someone gets hold of your password, it's probably going to be completely useless to them. So two-factor is something you really need to always be thinking about.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. We'll go to Kevin in Philadelphia. Good morning, Kev. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good evening, George. How are you?
Wonderful.
I'd like to talk for a minute about Windows XP. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
First of all, run Malwarebytes and run your system. Restore back a couple of days. It should get rid of any problem you have. Make sure you're logged in as administrator. I love XP because it's so stable. I hate Windows 7 because I get errors. Like, I got to go out and go to the library, use the computer. And even though they got a brand new system, and I get errors like I could not display the web page. Internet Explorer stopped working. I hate it. I love XP, and I won't use anything else. I know it like the back of my hand. And can you? What would you have to say to me about that? And why isn't Windows 7 as stable as XP is?
7 actually is pretty stable on modern hardware, on newer hardware. I have a couple of 7 systems that I use all the time. I also use a lot of Linux systems. I have a couple of XP systems still kind of sitting around in the back there, too. But I found that 7 has been stable for me. But like all these systems, it's dependent on what kind of hardware you have. The issue with XP going forward is going to be primarily the security one, because with Microsoft no longer sending, at least saying at this point, that they're not going to send any more security updates to XP systems, that means that not right now, not today, but down the line and over time, as more and more exploits start to circulate out there, the probability of one or more of them being in a position to at least potentially affect your system and anyone's XP system is going to be increasing. Does this mean the system's going to go molten tomorrow? No. It may have years of good service left in it, but we don't really know, because we don't know what kind of exploits are going to be coming that under ordinary support conditions would have been fixed by Microsoft but won't be now.
You know, Lauren, on this laptop that I was talking to you about that had the Windows XP on it, clearly it does because I've been getting notices that things aren't working right. But there's a little sticker on it that says Windows Vista. So I'm really confused.
If the machine, you know, that's usually, that sticker's usually put on there by the, you know, by the OEM, right? So they,
right.
So
right.
They, when they load
it's a Dell
the
computer.
Yeah. So, yeah. So they have the piece of hardware, they have the notebook, and then they have their distribution system for loading it with the OS. And normally when they put a Vista sticker on there, they would have loaded it with Vista. Now there were weird things that have happened. I mean, there were situations where people, when Vista came out, there were people who said, "I don't want Vista, I just want XP." And they said, okay, we'll put XP on this one instead of Vista." So depending on what kind of channels you got that, you know, that laptop through, possibly something like that happened, because Vista got a bad name for itself very, very quickly.
Okay, maybe that's what happened then. Okay, let's go to Rob, truck driving in Mississippi. There you go, Robbie. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, George. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a question for your guest. I've been working on trying to decide which program to use to write a program. I want to have multiple connections to the program at the same time. What would be the best, most secure program? The graphically the best one, the most compatible, you know, overall stability. What, in his opinion, is the best? Visual Basic, Java, C++, C#. I cannot make my mind up as to which program to get fluent with.
Boy, that's a tough call, because it's so dependent on exactly what your end application is going to be, what kind of hardware it's going to be on. Is it something you're going to be mostly running on your local computer, or are you going to be using cloud services to run it? In general, most of, you know, you listed a litany there of mostly modern languages. There's a lot that's done in C++. There's a lot that's done in JavaScript. There's a lot that's done in Java. They each have their different place. They all have their pluses and their minuses. I just can't make a general statement on that without really knowing what it is you intended to do and what kind of environment you intended to do it in, because it really is a very specialized kind of decision depending on all the specifics of what's going to be involved.
To go back to Rob. Rob, how are you going to use it? Maybe he can help you there.
I'm going to use it on a cloud server. I'm going to write a card game is what it's going to be. Texas Hold'em mainly, but it's going to be an authentic card game, unlike the poker sites you go to. It's going to be, you know, a poker site basically, but it's going to be 180 degrees from any poker site that anybody's been on. People are going to have an opportunity to win stuff, but it's not going to cost the user a dime to use it. And I expect it to be pretty popular.
Yeah, I think the best way to handle that, if you're going to be using, you know, cloud services to do it, is going to be to compare carefully, you know, to look at the various major players in that. Google has their cloud services. Microsoft has their new cloud services now. Obviously, Amazon has AWS. Those are, you know, the three major players that you would likely be looking at, especially if you're starting off kind of small. And each of them has different languages and capabilities, and also charging mechanisms. You know, the way they charge for services varies in different ways. And what I would recommend is just kind of looking at the spec sheets and the cost sheets for each of those. Most of them will give you a certain amount of free access under some circumstances. That's a good way to get started, and then you can scale upward from there. But again, it's going to be very dependent on how you're actually going to do it.
Okay, Rob, good luck to you. Next up, we go to Bernard in Torrance, California, west of the Rockies. You're on with Lauren Weinstein. Go ahead, Bernard.
Good evening, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I purchased a device called a Safe Plug, and I'm curious, first of all, if you know about that, if you've heard of it.
What does it do?
Basically, it disguises your location on the internet. You plug it into your router, and it bounces you through the Tor network, the Onion router. If you're familiar with that.
Yeah. All right. So it's a Tor. It's basically a Tor router then, of some sort. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering what sort of background or advice, or don't use it, or use it, or it doesn't matter, or.
I am not, you know, there are a lot of people who use Tor for all sorts of purposes. I'm not a Tor user, and I don't recommend use of Tor for various reasons. But I think, generally speaking, the most important one is that I think the security and privacy promises that people think they're going to get from using Tor networks are often not borne out by reality. Because of poor implementations, because of the way exit nodes work, all kinds of things like that. So I just am not a fan of Tor generally. It's a fascinating technology. It's a fascinating concept. But I just don't think it necessarily does everything that people expect it to do.
Are governments actively planning to try to hack into other governments' utilities and things like that?
Well, that's kind of what governments do, right? I mean, it's kind of interesting. With all the talk about intelligence agencies and NSA and the GCHQ in England and the Russian equivalent and the China equivalent and the North Korean equivalent and all the rest, people sometimes have kind of forgotten what those intelligence agencies were created to do, right? They were created to exploit flaws in systems and communication systems, and to gather intelligence for their countries. Now, we can argue about the policies that led to that in any given country. We can argue about what they do with that capability, whether they use it for domestic censorship or to attack foreign governments or whatever. But I think it's completely reasonable to expect, this isn't endorsing it, but just a statement of the way it is, to expect that governments who feel that they have adversaries are going to be looking for every technological avenue they can find to, if necessary, attack those adversaries, even if that means in ways that don't necessarily mean bullets. Now, as a lot of what we hear about infrastructure attacks, like attacks on the power grid and water systems and things like that, is a lot of that hyped? Yeah, a lot of it is hyped because there's a lot of money to be made trying to sell things associated with cyber war and protecting against cyber terror and all that. This is big, big bucks. It's the cyber intelligence defense complex. Does that mean there aren't real risks? No, there are real risks because our infrastructure, our electrical infrastructure in particular, is very old. A lot of the control systems use very poor security, sometimes, you know, just ludicrously poor security. And could be exploited, but that doesn't necessarily mean they will be comprehensive way. It means we have a lot of work to do, but we don't have to panic, I guess, is what I'm saying. It doesn't do any good to panic in these situations, because fixing these is not a snap your fingers process. It's always going to be a lot of work and a tough slog to do.
That's true. Let's go to Alice now in Cape Coral, Florida. Good morning, Alice.
Hi, George. Hey. I just first wanted to say I wanted to send a spiritual prayer for your sister, and I keep her in my thoughts.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
My siblings and I deal with mental illness and the cancer history. Mom and Dad both died of lung cancer. My question, basically, thank you for the topic. It's very thought-provoking, especially before we're dealing with an NSA and everything. I don't do any private, like, thoughts or any – I do porn. I have to say that. I'm a very casual user. And I noticed that with Internet Explorer, I get shut down a lot frequently, and I use HughesNet. What does your guest think about, like, the competing factors of web browsers? Because I'm getting them wiped off. Because I want to go with Firefox, and I'm not like touting them or trying to promote them. But I find that I don't get cut off as quick or at all with that browser. And I kind of want to leave it at that because I'm ADHD and I need to be quiet and listen. Thank you, George, for all the years of service.
Thank you. Go ahead, Lauren.
Yeah, well, there are, of course, a number of web browsers. You know, there's several majors and then a bunch of minors. As I've said before, I just to do my disclaimer here, I consult to Google. So, you know, what I'm saying here is my opinion, not their opinion. But even if I didn't consult to Google, I would be using Chrome because I just think that Chrome is a good browser for what I want to do. For some people really like Firefox. Firefox has a different model in a lot of ways, and it does different things. It has each of these browsers tends to have a different kind of security model that they employ, emphasizing different things and de-emphasizing other things. I am not a big fan of Internet Explorer, though, you know, to be fair, it has improved over time. They have some good new privacy enhancements, too. So it's one of those situations where you really have to kind of, you know, really try them all. I mean, they're all free, first off, right? So, I mean, you can test Chrome, you can test Firefox, you can test Internet Explorer. You can have them all installed on a typical Windows system anyway at once. Use them for different things. I know a lot of people who actually do that. They will use different browsers for different purposes. They will have different accounts logged into different browsers. So you really don't have to feel that you're locked into one, but if you do find one that fulfills your needs, then by all means, stick with it. I mean, that's kind of my attitude on this.
I have found that you consult for Google, so we want the world to know that. But I have found that when I use the traditional Google, I can't get to some websites, like, you know, there may be a YouTube thing that you can't see. But if you use Chrome, Google Chrome, it does work. Why is that?
There shouldn't be any reason. There shouldn't be any reason for that. You know, given no problem with your ISP or some other factor like that, because those sites are all general access sites that don't do anything, you know, particularly fancy.
So something's going else.
What usually happens when people find things like that, it's usually because, regardless of which browser you use, there are ways to get yourself into confused kind of states. If you're, you know, logging in and logging out, you have different accounts. Sometimes you will, you know, cookies will get confused in these browsers. If the cookies are these are the cookies that know that you're logged in, so that you don't have to keep logging in, you know, every time you go back. If those cookies disappear or are confused in some way, you can have problems. Usually, if you go into the system, kind of blow away the cookies and log in again for any of these browsers, that'll sometimes make a big difference. But generally speaking, for these major sites, for YouTube and for, you know, CNN or whatever site you're talking about, these browsers should you know, all have access in a pretty much equivalent way.
Okay, let's go to, do we have time? Of course. George is in Canada on the international line. Hey, George, go ahead.
Yes, I'm glad that you took my call. Geez, this is the first time I've ever been on here. And thank you, George, for having me on your show. You hear me okay?
Yeah, but go ahead, because the clock's going to get us.
Okay, yeah, with Windows XP, I've had successful upgrades to Windows 7, but for the people that can't upgrade from Windows XP to Windows 7 or Windows 8, and everyone hates Windows 8 as much as Vista, I found success with Ubuntu Linux and Linux Mint, and that seems to be a good alternative for people with older XP computers.
Yeah, it can be an excellent alternative if the applications you need are there and you're comfortable in that. I use Linux on a bunch of machines myself. I have Linux servers. I have Linux desktops. Not everybody is comfortable with them because if you really, really have to use Outlook on your PC, though now there are, you know, ways to do this online and in the cloud also, for example, then you're kind of stuck with Windows. But if you're mainly, for example, doing web browsing, if you're mainly using applications over the web, then definitely a nice clean Linux distribution, and you mentioned a couple, there are a whole bunch of them now. They are very lightweight. An old piece of equipment, an old piece of hardware will function like a brand new computer with some of these Linux OSs, and they're great for certain applications.
Well, Lauren, thanks again for being on the program. This hour just flew by. It was a Tech Hour with Lauren Weinstein. Up next, we talk about the boom. Stand by.